All right, let's dive into ancient Israel. We're going to be unpacking a lecture by Dr. Robert Van Noy.
Okay.
He takes us through a super pivotal period, the divided kingdom, you know, that century after King Solomon's reign.
Yeah.
From 931 to 841 BC, when things get a little messy.
Yeah.
We're talking, you know, political maneuvering, rebellion, divine intervention.
Lots of drama.
Yeah. And we even have some archaeological treasures.
Right.
That back up the biblical account. It's like, I don't know, Game of Thrones, but with like higher stakes.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a fascinating period. And what's really interesting is this division, it didn't just happen overnight. It was more like these cracks, you know, spreading over time.
Right.
And those cracks, well, they were influenced by geography, mm-hmm. tribal dynamics, and even possibly some royal favoritism, like Dr. Van Noy points out.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, those cracks spreading. He talks about this Gibeonite wedge, which sounds a bit like something out of, I don't know, a military strategy game.
It does, doesn't it?
Can you break that down for us a little bit? What is that?
Yeah. It is kind of like a strategic wedge, I guess, but it's really all about geography, shaping politics.
Okay.
So you remember the Gibeonites?
Yeah.
Joshua made a treaty with them way, way back.
Right, right.
And their cities, well, they formed this kind of buffer zone.
Okay.
Right in the middle of Canaan. Almost naturally dividing north from south.
Okay.
And then you've got the two most powerful tribes, you know,
right.
Judah in the south and Ephraim in the north. And they were already, you know, rivals.
Oh, yeah. So it's like having these two heavyweights in the same ring, just waiting for the bell to ring.
Exactly.
And I remember even like the legendary King David, you know.
Yeah.
Initially, he only ruled over Judah for a time.
That's right.
Almost foreshadowing the division to come.
Exactly. And there's even a theory that Solomon, you know, David's son and heir, might have favored his own tribe, Judah, during his reign. And if that's true, it certainly wouldn't have helped smooth over those tensions.
Right? No, not at all. Okay, so we've got this powder keg of geographic and tribal rivalry. Maybe some simmering resentment.
Yeah.
And then enters Jeroboam,
yes.
our soon-to-be king of the north. Tell me he was at least a little bit of a rebel.
Oh, Jeroboam was ambitious, without a doubt. He was running Solomon's public works projects up in the north.
Okay.
And then the prophet Ahijah appears.
Oh, boy.
With a very dramatic prophecy.
Okay.
He tears a cloak into 12 pieces.
Wow.
Gives Jeroboam 10 of them.
Okay.
And declares that he'll be getting 10 tribes. The kingdom splitting.
Wow. That's a pretty powerful image.
It is.
You can practically feel the weight of that prophecy. But wait, Solomon wasn't dead yet, right?
You're right. Ahijah made it clear that this would happen after Solomon died, not immediately.
Okay.
But it seems Jeroboam was a bit impatient. He tried to force the issue and staged a premature rebellion.
So what was Solomon's reaction? I mean, did he just let it slide?
Hardly. He tried to kill him.
Wow.
Jeroboam had to flee to Egypt for safety.
Now that's some serious drama.
It is.
So Jeroboam's off in Egypt, probably plotting his revenge.
Probably.
Meanwhile, Solomon dies, and his son, Rehoboam, is set to inherit the throne. I have a feeling this transition wasn't exactly smooth sailing.
You're picking up on it. Rehoboam may be sensing some insecurity about his claim to the whole kingdom.
Right.
He headed north to be confirmed by the tribes. You know, he needed their buy-in.
Right.
And they came to him with a pretty reasonable request.
Oh, yeah.
Lighten up on the taxes and forced labor that Solomon had imposed.
That seems fair enough. So how did Rehoboam respond to that?
He completely fumbled it. He went to his father's old advisors, you know, who wisely suggested he work with the people.
Okay, yeah.
But then he talked to his buddies,
you know,
these young hotheads.
Whoa, no.
And they told him to basically become a tyrant.
Uh-oh, I can see where this is going. What did he do?
He let that arrogance get to him.
Oh, no.
And uttered the infamous line that Dr. Van Noy quotes. My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions.
Talk about a PR disaster.
I know.
He basically told the northern tribes he was going to treat them even worse than his father. What was their reaction?
They rejected him outright.
Yeah.
They declared, What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel.
Wow.
They declared independence right there on the spot.
What?
And the kingdom was officially split.
Wow.
The 10 northern tribes formed their own kingdom, Israel.
Right.
While the southern tribes remain loyal to the Davidic dynasty as Judah.
So the kingdom is divided. I'm guessing Rehoboam wasn't just going to accept that quietly.
Yeah, of course not. He assembled an army, ready to crush this rebellion by force. But before he could attack, a prophet named Shemaiah appeared with a message from God. Stand down. This division was happening, and it was by divine design.
Even kings had to answer to a higher power. But if Rehoboam couldn't conquer the north militarily, how did he handle the situation?
Well, this is where we see Shishak, the pharaoh of Egypt, enter the picture.
Okay.
He attacks Jerusalem.
Okay.
Now, at first, it might seem like just another power play.
Right.
But we actually have evidence from outside the Bible that confirms and expands on this account.
Wait, you're telling me there's archaeological proof that backs up this biblical story?
It's true.
That's incredible. Tell me more.
Dr. Van Noy mentions a victory inscription on the walls of a temple in Thebes.
Okay.
Shishak boasts about all the cities he plundered.
Okay.
And get this, they're not just in Judah.
Right.
He hit cities in the northern kingdom, too.
That's really interesting. So even though Jeroboam had sought refuge with Shishak back in Egypt, that didn't stop the pharaoh from raiding his cities, too.
Nope.
It seems like personal relationships meant little in the face of power and ambition back then.
That's right.
Even someone who had sheltered you could turn on you in an instant.
Absolutely. And there's more. A fragment of a monument bearing Shishak's name was found at Megiddo, suggesting, you know, he established a victory marker there. It's a tangible piece of history connecting us to these events from thousands of years ago.
Right.
Really makes you realize that these weren't just stories in a book. These were real people living in a complex world.
It's incredible to have those tangible connections to the past. So we've covered geography, prophecies, rebellions, foreign invasions, and we've only just scratched the surface of the divided kingdom. Where do we go from here?
Well, next we delve into the reigns of Rehoboam's successors in Judah.
Okay.
Abijah and Asa. And their stories are just as packed with intrigue and faith and some pretty surprising details.
Sounds intriguing. Let's start with Abijah. Dr. Vinoy mentions his name appears in both forms, Abijah and Abijo. Is that a clue about his character, maybe?
It certainly hints at a more complex character.
Okay.
His reign was short, only 3 years. And the biblical accounts we have, well, they paint a rather mixed picture of his faith.
A mixed picture. So was he a good king or a bad king?
Well, in 1 Kings, we hear that Abijah committed all the sins his father had done before him. His heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David, his forefather, had been.
That doesn't sound too promising. But you mentioned mixed accounts. What else do we know?
Yeah, so in 2 Chronicles, we get this really dramatic scene where Abijah leads the army of Judah against Jeroboam, the king of Israel,
right,
who was attacking from the north.
Okay.
And the chronicler really emphasizes that Judah won a decisive victory, you know, because they relied on the Lord, the God of their fathers. They even inflicted heavy casualties on the Israelite army.
So in one book, he's a sinner who's not devoted to God. And in the other, he's leading his army to victory in God's name.
Yeah.
That's quite a contradiction. I mean, is there a way to kind of reconcile these two accounts?
Well, it's a fascinating example of how history is often written from different perspectives.
Right.
And even the Bible presents, you know, a nuanced view of its characters.
Okay, yeah.
It seems Abijah was a man who struggled with his faith, but ultimately, you know, God's mercy preserved Jerusalem from being destroyed, whether by Shishak's attack or by Jeroboam's invasion.
It makes you wonder about the pressures these ancient kings faced and the decisions they had to make. It's a reminder that they weren't just, you know, figures in a history book. They were real people.
Yeah.
Grappling with complex situations. Speaking of complex, let's move on to Asa, Abijah's successor. What can you tell us about him?
Now, Asa was a major player. He ruled for a whopping 41 years, longer than Saul, David, or even Solomon. And he's described as a good king, one whose heart was right before God.
41 years. That's an incredibly long reign. What made Asa such a standout king? What did he do differently?
He seems to have taken his religious reforms very seriously. He got rid of idols, expelled temple prostitutes, and even deposed his own grandmother because she was involved with pagan worship.
Wow, that's a powerful statement of faith.
It is.
He definitely sounds like a reformer. But there's always a but, isn't there? Dr. Vinor mentioned something about high places.
Ah, yes, the high places. It's a recurring theme in the books of Kings. Even those kings who are described as good and faithful to God are sometimes criticized for not getting rid of these high places. It does make you wonder why.
So what were these high places exactly? What made them so problematic?
High places were essentially local shrines, often located on hills where people worshipped.
Okay.
The problem was that they were sometimes linked to practices that went against the official religion of the Israelites,
right,
creating this tension between tradition and reform.
So it's like trying to blend the old ways with the new faith.
Yeah.
And that didn't sit well with everyone. But Asa didn't get rid of them.
It seems not. The text says, although he did not remove the high places, Asa's heart was fully committed to the Lord all his life. It's a caveat, acknowledging his overall faithfulness, but still pointing out this area where he fell short.
That's really interesting. Even the good kings had their flaws and inconsistencies. It makes them seem more human, more relatable.
Absolutely. It also raises some important questions about how religious practices and beliefs evolved in ancient Israel. Was the problem with the high places themselves? Or was it more about how they were being used? Were there different interpretations of what constituted true worship? You know, these are things scholars still debate today.
Yeah. I love how a deep dive like this unearths so many questions and nuances.
Right.
It's not just about, memorizing names and dates, but grappling with the complexities of history and faith. What else did Dr. Vinoy have to say about Asa's reign? Did he face any significant challenges?
Well, besides the high places issue, Dr. Vinoy focuses on Asa's military successes.
Okay.
And his efforts to fortify Judah against external threats. You know, remember, this is the divided kingdom period. Tensions were high, and every kingdom was looking over its shoulder.
Right. It's like a constant Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
With all the political maneuvering and power struggles. Did Asa have any conflicts with the northern kingdom, with Israel?
We know there were conflicts with Israel during Abijah's reign, but Dr. Vinoy doesn't go into detail about any specific confrontations between Asa and the kings of Israel.
Okay.
However, it's important to remember that this was a period of constant tension and intermittent warfare between the two kingdoms.
It sounds like a very volatile time. Speaking of volatile, what's going on with Jeroboam up north? He's still king of Israel, right?
He is, but his story takes some pretty wild turns.
Okay.
Remember, he was chosen by God to lead the northern tribes.
Yeah.
But he made some questionable choices.
Oh, what kind of choices are we talking about? What did he do?
Well, he seemed very concerned with keeping the Israelites, loyal to him.
Right.
And not running back to Jerusalem to worship at the temple.
That makes sense. A newly formed kingdom would want to establish its own identity, right?
Right.
And prevent its citizens from being drawn back to the old power center.
Mm-hmm.
So what steps did Jeroboam take to kind of secure his power and prevent people from returning to Jerusalem?
He went pretty far. He set up two golden calves.
Okay.
One at Bethel and one at Dan. And basically told the people, hey, these are your new gods. No need to travel all the way to Jerusalem anymore.
That choice of symbol is fascinating. It seems like Jeroboam is intentionally invoking a powerful but problematic part of Israel's history.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't the golden calf incident get Moses into some serious trouble?
Resh.
Way back in the day?
Exactly. It's a direct echo of the sin of idolatry that the Israelites committed in the wilderness.
Right.
After escaping Egypt, Jeroboam is essentially repeating the mistakes of the past, even as he's trying to forge a new future for the northern kingdom.
That's a pretty bold move considering their history. How did this go over with God?
Not well, to put it mildly, Dr. Vinoy doesn't go into detail about the specific consequences in this lecture.
Okay.
But the biblical account makes it clear that Jeroboam's actions set a disastrous precedent for the kings who came after him. The northern kingdom was plagued by political instability, yeah, idolatry, and ultimately destruction at the hands of the Assyrians.
It's almost as if this cycle of rebellion and consequence kept repeating itself.
It did.
It really makes you think about the choices leaders make, yeah, and the impact those choices have for generations. It's a reminder that power without wisdom and a sense of accountability can be very destructive.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key takeaways from Dr. Vinoy's lecture. This isn't just, a dry recitation of ancient history.
Right.
It's a story full of drama, intrigue, and ultimately a powerful reflection on the human condition. We see the fragility of power, the allure of ambition, the consequences of bad decisions. and the enduring power of faith.
We've seen kings defying prophets, foreign powers invading, the legacy of Solomon crumbling before our eyes. What do you think this deep dive into the divided kingdom tells, you know, the listeners in the 21st century? What can we learn from these ancient stories?
I think they remind us that the past is never truly past.
Yes.
It shapes who we are and the world we live in.
Right.
These stories challenge us to think critically about leadership, the use and abuse of power, and the importance of making choices that lead to a just and flourishing society.
Though there's some powerful insights. Listener, I hope this deep dive has sparked your curiosity to learn more about this tumultuous period in history. It's a story that continues to resonate thousands of years later, reminding us of the timeless struggles of humanity, our thirst for power, our yearning for meaning, and our search for a better future. So keep diving, keep questioning, and keep seeking knowledge.